A note on this week's podcast, it was recorded about 1 hour before the announcement that President Donald Trump has in fact been indicted on multiple felony counts.
This is a Republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the Cheaper by the Dozen edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. Michigan's quality guru, Perry Johnson, now has a lot of other competition, some of very obscure, even more obscure than him, arguably, candidates for the Republican nomination for president. We have learned this week that not only did Chris Christie and Mike Pence jump into the race, but the governor of North Dakota, the very formidable Doug Burgum, even in North Dakota, they're wondering who the hell this guy is. He's jumped into the presidential race. We'll take a look at this most unusual cadre of candidate, as well as the quixotic Democratic campaign of the Kennedy family's black sheep.
I'm Mark Brewer. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by veteran state capitol reporter Kyle Malin, news editor of the Insider Mears newsletter for the state capitol, where he has been for the last 22 years. He's also the co-host of the Mears Monday podcast. Jeff, you touched on a lot of interesting topics there, but I want to get your take on this. Just a week ago, Republicans are hailing, Kevin McCarthy, the speaker. You know, he made his caucus function. He got a budget deal through and a debt deal through, but yet now he's back in the same old fights. He can't even get a bill to the floor of the House this week. What's going on? Who's fighting him? What's the pushback?
Well, first, I guess I've had a little more time to reflect and think about what happened with the debt ceiling fight. And, you know, Kevin McCarthy, as he's done throughout his political career, has underwhelmed and he underperformed in that debt ceiling battle. Kevin McCarthy didn't quite deliver 2/3 of his own caucus to the sum total of votes for the debt ceiling. He had promised a minimum of 150 votes. He didn't get that many. That deal was Kevin McCarthy delivered the bare minimum and actually a little less than the bare minimum that he needed to contribute to that deal. That deal was consummated by the artful political skills of the guy the Republicans like to claim is a dementia-addled, drooling fool, Joe Biden, and the very adept leadership of Hakeem Jeffries, who has successfully succeeded Nancy Pelosi as a very skilled operative in Washington. And not enough credit has been given to Chuck Schumer and very quietly the leadership of Mitch McConnell to deliver the necessary Republican votes in the Senate to get that done quickly. So what we've seen this week now is the Freedom Caucus, which is small in number compared to the 222 or whatever number of Republicans there are in that caucus, but they're big enough to grind the entire function of the House to a halt on simple procedural matters that have not allowed business to move this week is a sign of their displeasure for the way McCarthy handled that process. And in securing his speakership in that very painful, long, drawn-out 15-ballot debacle back in January, McCarthy had to effectively give away all the power, or nearly all of the power, that the speaker once possessed. And then any one of these Freedom Caucus members has the ability to effectively call for to vacate the chair and force the House to again vote on selecting a speaker. And so they might be small in number, only a couple dozen, but they can deny Kevin McCarthy the ability to function. They can deny him the ability to lead if they so choose, and they can strip him of his power if they choose. They are big enough to in number to do that. And so they're flexing their muscle. They're having what amounts to a temper tantrum, but it's significant. They're reminding McCarthy that they are going to be wagging the dog and not him telling them how they're going to behave. In the old days, the speaker would have, stripped them of committees, rubbed their nose in the carpet, and taught them not to pee there anymore. that there, he doesn't have the ability to do that. And that's what we've seen in Washington.
Well, you know, they've still got some very important legislation they got to pass. I mean, they did do the budget deal and the debt ceiling, but they actually have to pass a budget, you know, by this fall, or else we face continuing resolutions and all the chaos that that brings. So it seems to me like McCarthy isn't actually any better off than he was, and whatever credit he got for the budget and debt deal, like you said, hasn't earned him any points with the Freedom Caucus and may have set him back with that caucus, because at any time they could move to vacate the chair, right? Any single Republican in the conference can file a motion to vacate the chair. And then we're back to where we were in February.
Yeah, but it's been kind of interesting watching some of the division, even within the some of the most visible, high-profile Freedom Caucus kooks that have, you know, typically see on cable news, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, who've sided with Kevin McCarthy and have drawn fire from some of their own allies within the Freedom Caucus for being sellouts. And so this intra-party fighting is it's not abnormal to have intra-party divisions on either side. It is historically abnormal to have them spill over so frequently and so visibly into the public. And that seems to be the modus operandi for Republicans. They just want to fight. They don't care who they fight. They're as content fighting with each other as they are fighting with Democrats. And they're feasting up on themselves in Washington. They're feasting up on themselves across the country. They're feasting up on themselves in Michigan, as there are tremendous intra-party fights between the factions that were fighting earlier this year when they selected their party chairman. And I know we will plan to talk to Kyle Malin about that later in this podcast.
Well, Jeff, you know, in other developments, you talked about this in your opening comments there. You know, the presidential race this year, it seems like every day I open up my news sources and there's another Republican presidential candidate in. Clearly, neither DeSantis nor Trump is scaring anybody off, but Trump actually probably benefits from having all these folks. But here's a guy, Trump, who this week was told by the U.S. attorney that he is the target of the criminal investigation over the documents and their mishandling down at Mar-a-Lago. But again, that just seemed to be, you know, business as usual, him turning himself into a martyr. You know, what's your assessment of the state of the Republican nominating process at this point?
There's reports that there's a federal indictment or indictments looming, and that they pertain, yes, to the Mar-a-Lago documents case, and the Espionage Act has been mentioned specifically, in addition to presidential records and other things. Obstruction of justice has been mentioned. But there's also growing speculation and leaks that are happening to say that that's not the scope, necessarily the limit of the scope of what we can expect from the Department of Justice, maybe as soon as tomorrow or next week, and that the indictments could very well include actions leading up to and related to January 6th and the aftermath of the election, because the word is that Mark Meadows, Trump's chief of staff at the end of his term and through the transition and Biden's inaugural, has become whether reluctantly or not, a cooperating witness, that he's going to plead guilty to certain federal crimes in exchange for his testimony and leniency. And so that might be some firsthand corroborating and record witness to some of the conspiracy involving efforts to impede the peaceful transfer of power from Donald Trump, who lost the election, to Joe Biden, who won it. And so the depth and breadth of these charges are still speculative, but could be enormous. And I say all of that in a normal world that existed before 2015 or 2016, this would be earth-shattering, it would be devastating, and it would be fatal to any candidate. It seems to be baked into the price of the stock with Trump, that this isn't going to in any way appreciably, it's not going to decrease his support, and it could arguably increase his support, as most of his crises and incidents that have been said, well, this will be the time the Republicans pivot. This will bring the Republicans to their senses. This will be when the Republicans break from Trump. Well, every time someone has predicted that, especially the collective wisdom has predicted that, just the opposite proves true. And the Ron DeSantis has been skidding and sputtering since he's not just since he launched his campaign a couple of weeks ago. He's stumbled into that and has been stumbling since, but he's been stumbling for months and months. His poll numbers have been decreasing. He seems to be betting all of his efforts into few of the early states. We've got now Chris Christie, who has no chance whatsoever to win the Republican nomination. He knows that, but he has determined he's going to be a human Scud missile aimed directly at Donald Trump, regardless of his motivation, regardless of his sincerity. I welcome anybody who's willing to take down Donald Trump. So Godspeed to Chris Christie. Mike Pence, he hasn't necessarily demonstrated any great bravery in his launch so far. And they say that Mike Pence is going to really contrast himself to Donald Trump. We'll see. Again, I welcome that. But Mike Pence has zero chance to be the Republican nominee. Hillary Clinton will be the Republican nominee before Mike Pence will. It's just a political reality. He has even less self-awareness than he has political sense, but that doesn't stop some big donors from backing him. He was in Michigan recently, appearing with Betsy DeVos at a symposium in Michigan just last week. So the field is growing. The North Dakota governor, Republican billionaire, who has the ability to write big checks to his campaign, his personal money means he has the wherewithal to stay in here where others might have to fold up their tents. But even in North Dakota, they're wondering who the hell this guy is. He doesn't have any prayer of being the Republican nominee. I have no idea what would motivate somebody to tilt it at this windmill when he has less awareness and less chance of somebody who has no awareness and no chance, like Perry Johnson, who we've joked about many times on this podcast, a guy who can't get himself on the ballot in Michigan, who's passing on a U.S. Senate race that's wide open because he thinks he has a better chance to be president of the United States. I mean, it's absurd. You or I have just as much chance of being president, being nominated by the Republicans as Perry Johnson does. And so it's all of this to say the only chance mathematically, I believe, that the Republicans would have ever had to beat Donald Trump would be a one-on-one match without anybody dividing up the vote. I still question whether or not somebody like Ron DeSantis would have the chops or staying power to do it, but it's all theoretical. It's not going to, there's going to be many candidates in the race. It's going to be a redo of 2016 where Donald Trump, at that time, he didn't get 50% of the vote in many states. But because of the winner take all rules on the Republican side, was able to amass 100% of the delegates in a lot of states, or certainly the lion's share of the delegates in a lot of states. This time he's polling stronger in most of these states, above 50% in many of these key states. He shows every sign of being able to replicate his march to the nomination that he did in the crowded field of 2016. So that's my long-winded view of things. I'd love to get your perspective as a longtime student of presidential politics and hear your observations.
Yeah, no, Jeb, I mean, I agree with virtually everything you said. I just actually, you're right. And nobody in the Republican Party has learned the lesson of 2016, that a big field like this just helps Trump because he's got a very dedicated, maybe 35 to 40% of the Republican vote in every state. And they are just slavishly devoted to him. He managed to turn every indictment, every accusation, everything into, I'm a martyr, the deep state is after me, et cetera, et cetera. And, all these folks jump into the race and all they do is help Trump. I suppose if the field were to thin dramatically early on, we may end up with the one-on-one scenario that you described. But, it's not hard to stay in the presidential race, right? And leave your name on the ballot and continue to campaign, And some of these candidates are quite wealthy. You mentioned the North Dakota governor and some of these other folks as well. They've got some potential staying power. DeSantis does, Pence, and they've got super PACs. So I don't see them dropping out, even if they don't do well in those early states. I suppose Trump could stumble somehow in some of these early states. But, again, I think the odds are right now he is the Republican nominee for president next year and everything that brings. But, I actually want to turn the conversation. The Republican Party is not the only party with crazy presidential candidates. We got one on the Democratic side, His father is one of my heroes. Now, Senator Robert Kennedy, the senior, this week was the sad anniversary of his assassination. 68, I think he would have made a fabulous president. But now we got his son who, just, you know, people like him because of his name, but they know absolutely nothing about his views. He's been an anti-vaxxer for years. Now he's trafficking. He's been trafficking in all these COVID conspiracy theories, the deep state, so much so that, you know, Fox and all these right-wing media outlets are giving him airtime because they see him as a way to, you know, he can get them votes in the Democratic Party process. You only need 15% of the vote in a Democratic primary or a caucus to get delegates. Just on his name alone, he could get that. And it's just going to be a major embarrassment. Biden has refused to debate him. I think that's the correct approach. But frankly, I'd like to see the National Party simply declare Bobby Kennedy Jr. as a non-candidate, like we did to Lyndon LaRouche a few years ago when I was chair. And we're simply not going to recognize him as a candidate. He's not qualified and so forth, but he's out there. And I think, you know, is a problem for the Democrats that the Democrats can't ignore. They got to do something about Bobby Kennedy Jr.
No, you're right. I mean, his name is, you know, Bobby Kennedy is a gold standard in Democratic politics for sure. But across the political spectrum, a man that is his legend in stature has only grown over these last 55 years since his assassination. And because of that, the name has to be taken seriously. And then the name is what is elevating Bobby Kennedy Jr. You mentioned his outlandish radical views on vaccinations and COVID, but his rhetoric, pro-Kremlin, pro-Putin, anti-Ukraine rhetoric is even more alarming. I mean, he sounds like many of the Republicans today. And that goes into the fact that there's no secret that he is taking the counsel of people like Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, and they are claiming credit in donor circles for, pardon me, putting him up and helping him as a threat, somebody to take some bark off of Biden. I mean, he's effectively, they see themselves as manipulating these right-wing extremists with ties to the most extreme Proud Boys and these fringe militia groups are taking credit for controlling this candidate whose mission is to hurt Joe Biden. So we need to expose it for what it is and call these people out for what they are. And the Democrats would be perfectly justified in not giving this guy credibility, effectively declaring him persona non grata within the party the way they did Lyndon LaRouche. That was how they dealt with that problem. And they would be well within the right.
Well, Jeff, you know, before we go to our guest this week, I think we should talk briefly about a tremendously surprising decision as the United States Supreme Court, as we record today. I've been busy all day, frankly. I haven't had a chance even to review it. But in a stunning decision, the United States Supreme Court today, 5-4, did not gut what's left of the Voting Rights Act. And they have required the state of Alabama to draw an additional African-American majority congressional district. You know, everybody thought that they were going to use this as, you know, the opportunity to drive one more nail in the coffin of the Voting Rights Act. But somehow, Chief Justice Roberts persuaded Justice Kavanaugh to join with the three progressives on the court. And in a 5-4 vote, again, they decided Alabama did its African-American community wrong, and they need to draw an additional congressional district on there. Now, this could have ramifications politically, obviously, with the House being so close. If there's a handful of districts in some states in the South, like Alabama, where another Democrat, African-American Democrat, could be elected, that could very easily tilt the House.
North Carolina, sure. There's other places.
I also think it's interesting in terms of the court's dynamics, because there has been a lot of solidarity by the group of basically six, and certainly five in most cases, if you take Roberts out. You know, look, they overturned Roe v. Wade a year ago. It's widely predicted they're going to get rid of affirmative action for the end of the term. And again, it was widely expected here that they would do that. So maybe, I don't want to get my hopes up too much, but maybe Roberts, Kaperswade, Kavanaugh, in some of these cases, not to go off the deep end with the likes of Alito and Thomas.
I love the dynamic of a powerful center, even if they're smaller in number than the extremes on either side, leveraging their limited power to forge those majorities. It's not unlike something like fusion voting that we have talked about. It is fascinating watching what could happen with this. I don't think that this is going to signal some kind of divergent, some great departure from a conservative court, but on select issues, Roberts has been very cautious about the appearance of the court. You know, that might sound ludicrous right now with the Clarence Thomas financial scandals going on, but Roberts is concerned about the appearance, the legacy, his legacy as Chief Justice. And if he's able to convince Kavanaugh to join him on occasion to join with the three liberals on the court, that will be interesting to watch how and when they choose those battles. It does pose some hope for sanity and pragmatism and not just raw partisanship coming out of the court.
Yeah, I mean, we've got cases like one out of Carolina about this so-called independent state legislature doctrine, which is very radical. And folks are looking forward to using it to assert that legislatures can basically decide who the electors are from their states, the voters be damned. And I hope certainly that Roberts and Kavanaugh can put an end to that and restrain that kind of development. Again, I don't want to overstate what happened here today. I think the court's in a very conservative spot. Time and again, they've surprised us by how bad they are. But this was quite a surprise today.
Mark and Jeff are joined by veteran Lansing journalist Kyle Malin. After these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
One thing I have learned in politics, not all pollsters are equal. There are a lot of bad polls and a small number of good ones. And that's why Epic MRA stands out. Epic MRA has been measuring Michigan public opinion for more than four decades. The company has earned a national reputation for integrity and accuracy. In fact, it is rated as the best polling company in Michigan by 538.com. The 2022 election is the latest example of why political professionals rely on Epic MRA. While a lot of other pollsters were calling the key races toss-ups, Epic MRA accurately reported that it looked like a Democratic sweep. And they also reported that the three ballot proposals would all win decisively, which is exactly what happened. It's not just politics. Epic MRA has been the go-to pollster for school districts, local governments, and independent groups who need to know what the public is thinking. If anyone asks me, I'm happy to recommend Epic MRA. For the best in public opinion research, head to epicmra.com.
I'm Lavora Barnes, chair of the Michigan Democratic Party and host of the MDP's new podcast, Party on the Peninsulas. Each week, we update our listeners on the people and policies that are moving Michigan forward. For the first time in 40 years, Michigan Democrats are able to enact an agenda that benefits the working people of our state instead of the privileged. Our Democratic leaders are doing it at a record-setting pace. We will bring you insights directly from these leaders along with the top news of the preceding week. Stay in the know. Join us every Monday morning for Party on the Peninsulas. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app or on our website, partyonthepeninsulas.com. Make Party on the Peninsulas a regular part of your week. Sign up for your free subscription. Do it today.
Joining us on the podcast is a veteran of state capitol journalism. Kyle Malin has been the editor of the MERS newsletter for 20 years. If you aren't familiar with their newsletter, it's a daily deep dive into everything happening in state government, a must read for leaders in state government, lobbyists, other journalists, and those who are interested in the goings on in Lansing. Kyle is also the host of the longest running political podcast in Michigan, the MERS Monday podcast, part of the Michigan political landscape for 13 years now.
Well, welcome back, Kyle, to the podcast. Really appreciate you being with us. Yeah, because we know you're on top of everything that's going on in Lansing, particularly in the legislature. So let me start with that. Where are we on the presidential primary? You know, we passed it, set a date in February. but it has not been given immediate effect. A couple other states out there are balking at moving. So what's going on here in Michigan in terms of our presidential primary?
Well, that's a great question, Mark. We're really at a standstill right now because we're not quite sure yet if this presidential primary, which is now set for February 27, is a go. And the reason is because in order to make it a go, the law has to be given immediate effect. It wasn't done in the legislature because the Republicans aren't excited about February 27. And so in order to make it happen, the legislature either has to adjourn early, which would be in the fall, September, maybe October at the latest, but we're here in September, or they're going to have to pass another bill and the Republicans are going to have to give it immediate effect. Now, there's problems with both of those. First of all, on the adjourning early problem, the Democratic legislature is not excited about that kind of proposition because it would require then the governor to call them back as part of a special session, and she would set the agenda. Now, that's not to say that it wouldn't be some kind of broad agenda that everybody could kind of do whatever they want anyway, but no legislator wants to basically surrender their power to the governor. So there's a lot of hesitancy about that. Then you could say, well, maybe we can get the Republicans to vote for immediate effect, to give this early primary immediate effect. But they're not going to do that because February 27 just absolutely doesn't work for them. According to their rules, if they were to agree to a primary that's February 27, anything earlier than March 1, they would lose 85% of their delegates. And Mark, you remember when the Republicans did this before, they tried to tempt fate and they had their primary on January 15 and the central committee, the Republican National Committee said, well, you're going to lose 50% of your delegates. And they're like, yeah, yeah, whatever. Well, they did. They lost those delegates and they had grassroots people who were kind of ticked off about it. Well, they don't want to lose 85% of their delegates now and lose even more of their power. And not that it, you know, it really makes any functional difference. It's just, you know, you hand these kind of things out like candy to your grassroots people. They don't really want to shaft them. So Eric Nesbitt, the Senate Minority Leader, says, hey, why don't we just solve this problem by making the primary March 1 or March 2, which is on a Saturday? We can have, it would work for Republicans, it would work for Democrats, it would be on a weekend so everybody could participate. Everybody would like it, but the clerks who would have to, of course, come in on the weekend, and who really wants to do that? And the other problem, of course, Mark, you probably have more knowledge on this than I do, but the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, set the date for February 27th, they set it for March 2. So, you know, there's some problems with doing that. But I guess the short answer to your question, where are we, the primary? We're really in a holding pattern right now. And I think people are waiting for something definitive to happen before there's another reaction.
Well, I hesitate to assign any kind of sentient thought or normalcy to the state Republican Party, who is also a player in this decision-making process. But Karamo, Christina Karamo, the current chair, and, you know, maybe I've heard rumblings that that might not be lasting, but the, you know, she has indicated, and the Trump campaign has signaled that they're not interested necessarily in participating in selecting delegates via a primary anyway, that they'd rather do this through a closed kind of caucus or party convention, as has also been done in the past. So the Republicans might not have any incentive to negotiate on this under any circumstance. And it might be left to the Democrats to figure out the immediate effect when they go sine-die, if they want to do this under the new proposed calendar or not. And, you know, you mentioned the way back when the Republicans moved up and lost 50% of their delegates in by holding a January primary. We also did this when Saul and I were at the party in the 2008 cycle. We moved up into February or late January, maybe early February. I can't remember which. If that's, I don't know if that's what you were talking about. We lost 50% of our delegates, but that was quickly resolved by we were awarded honorary delegate slots, and the grassroots were able to get their desired reward. So the party, I guess that's just a quick way of saying the party does have some tools at their disposal that give those delegates the kind of the Willy Wonka golden ticket I'm looking for, whether or not, you know, because, you know, I mean, most conventions are just a perfunctory rah-rah anyway. They're not delegates actually voting on a, you know, a divided convention where the decision is in question. And so by the time that comes around, all the people, whether they were the official half the delegates or the honorary half delegates, were all treated the same when it came down to it.
No, that's a good point about the, does the Republican Party, currently led by Christina Cuomo, really want a primary, or they want a convention? And it seemed like the convention idea would be a convenient exercise if it appeared like the Democrats were really putting the screws to them and say, well, you're going to have February 27 or nothing. And then they could say, oh, well, we'll do nothing because you all are putting us in a bad position, so we can say nothing. But if the date is moved to March 2, then they don't have the Democrats to use as scapegoats. So, I don't know in that circumstance if they'd really want that kind of closed convention and make them look even more insular than they look now. Yeah. And I know that, you know, Cuomo, you know, is kind of in power because of a very tight knit group. But I think maybe even she has to realize that in order to generate interest in this state or whoever the nominee is for the Republicans, it's better to have it available to everybody than just, you know, a couple hundred people.
Well, speaking of Cuomo, where is she, Kyle? Yeah, she's disappeared. Someone like, well, don't like, where's Waldo?
Living in a van down by the river.
She's like completely disappeared. I haven't seen her in the press. You didn't see her on Mackinac? I mean, what's going on with Cuomo and the Republican Party these days?
I have no idea. Right. She has not been accessible. And, you know, Jeff just kind of hinted as to, you know, made kind of a mention about whether she'll be around. I know that there are mechanisms, and maybe Jeff can speak about this more, within the party about being able to remove a chair if they're not functioning to a certain level after, I believe it's 3 months. And, you know, maybe she's, you know, maybe there's some pressure in that regard, or maybe she's just realizing that the real strength of a party is raising money. So maybe she's seeing no real value in going to Lansing and making a lot of noise, when if she isn't able to raise the dough to help anybody, her job is really pretty futile. And it really reduces the power of the state party to just a small collection of people who just debate ideas back and forth. I mean, that's kind of what the libertarians do. You know, they have these internal battles, and then they talk philosophy to each other. But at the end of the day, they're not really functional. They're not really a factor in the broader conversation. And that's kind of the road the Republicans are going down, unless they can actually raise money and be a factor in campaigns and organize and, you know, provide the support that a U.S. Senate candidate would need. I mean, look, you just saw how the House Republicans have had to recruit Rick Snyder and Bill Parfet and bring them back in order to make themselves look like, wow, this is a group that could actually raise some money and have some impact, because I'm not quite sure that they're convinced that Cuomo's going to be able to do it for them.
Well, this is really kind of bizarre, as didn't, if I recall, Snyder voted for Biden in 2020, didn't he?
Yeah, but he also put right to work into place, and now he's seeing right to work has been repealed, and he got rid of prevailing wage, and now prevailing wage is back. And so I think he's starting to see his legacy start to unravel. And I think, you know, that's more disconcerting for him. You know, when I heard him on the radio, he was on Michael Patrick Shields this week or last week, and he talked about, he didn't want to talk about U.S. Senate. He didn't want to talk about president. He didn't want to talk any of that. He just wanted to talk about state house. And that just kind of tells me that he's tunnel focused on this and is going to avoid talking about Trump and Cuomo at all costs.
That's funny, because he never cared about the state house when he was governor. And I also got to say now, you know, the ongoing Rick Johnson controversy and scandal. Snyder put Johnson on that board.
Yeah.
And now we hear this week that there were financial disclosure forms that should have been filed that have disappeared. That all falls on Snyder. It sounds to me like he could be a real juicy target for the Democrats here by being so visible.
Yeah, you know, the Flint water crisis stuff has not been completely put away yet. You know, he still had those criminal charges against him in the Flint water crisis. So, yeah, it's not like he's squeaky clean. And the Rick Johnson thing, yeah, he put Rick Johnson on that board when a lot of folks kind of questioned whether that was a good idea or not. So, yeah, but he's the best option they have right now, the House Republicans. He's a name. And so, you know, I guess you go with what you can do.
Well, I don't know if you saw the reaction from the Grand New Party caucus, the Steve Caras and Matt Maddox. They've gone apoplectic about Rick Snyder and, you know, his Biden support in Matt Hall and Greg Van Workum and others bringing Rick Snyder and Bill Parfet in under the umbrella. And it seems to be causing real division within their ranks. And, you know, I think that they're still small in number, but they represent about 10 or 12 of that, you know, what is it, 54 member caucus. I mean, it's about a quarter of the caucus is pretty pissed off right now at their own leadership. So that might be reminiscent of what we're seeing in Washington this week with the Freedom Caucus now kind of with their small numbers holding the rest of the House hostage on procedural matters. So, you know, I would never underestimate the ability of a Republican intra-family food fight spilling over into, you know, political kind of fallout here that works against their own self-interest. They don't seem to be very self-aware when it comes to that.
I think that's a good point, Jeff. And, you know, if the grand old party wants to get together their PAC that they've established and show that they have financial resources to get winning candidates across the finish line and win in general elections, well, shoot, they'll expand in number. And if they can fuel a majority, well, then we'll have Steve Cara as House Speaker, or we'll have Matt Maddox as the House Speaker. They can serve some more terms now because the term limit law changed. Bring it. And I think that's Matt Hall's thinking. You know, if you guys are all that popular, then you should have no problem raising the money it takes to have candidates who align with your way of thinking through primaries and then beat Democrats in competitive seats. But I think what we saw in the last election is that when those kind of races took place, those more conservative candidates, there was one I'm thinking of right now in that Washtenaw County, Livingston County area. You know, he got his butt kicked. He couldn't raise any money. He went to the party with his hat in his hand and they told him, your polling stinks and, you know, come back when you're more viable. And that didn't happen and he lost. And so, you know, these are the kinds of problems that the Freedom Caucus kind of runs into is, you know, in your area, you have a 60% or a 65% Republican base. You can go ahead and win those seats, but you're not going to win majority with that. You still have to win these 50 seats. And unless you're bringing money to the table to get, you know, palatable candidates in those districts elected, you're stuck in the minority.
Right.
Well, you know, it's interesting too, though, that the Democrats are not sitting back. They launched ads this week against six marginal Republicans in Southeast Michigan. That's pretty amazing. It is June of the off year. And they're going after these six marginal Republicans for their bad votes on gun safety. What do you make of all that, Kyle? What's going on?
I think the Democrats are being very smart about this. You know, why wait until the election year? Strike while the iron's hot. Let people know that Donnie Steele voted against red flag laws or Mark Tisdale voted against red flag laws. Hey, if you got the money to do it and launch some cable ads, why not? I think that's completely above board and a good tactic. And, you know, for some of the other ones, and I mentioned those two because those are the ones who have the cable ads on them and they're in Oakland County and Donnie Steele represents Oxford. So I think that those are good. When you start getting into the downriver areas, Jamie Thompson, gun control, I don't know how well that plays downriver and maybe that doesn't impact her as much. Well, when you're talking about Oakland County, I think that doesn't look good. I know that Representative Kuhn, I think he voted for one of those gun safety measures. And Matt Hall, who's the minority leader who also represents an increasingly competitive district, also voted for one of those gun control bills and took some heat from it from this gun owners group. and he'll probably get some negative rankings from the NRA. But, you know, even Matt Hall's got to look after number one here and realize that the polling, especially among independents, is not on their side on this issue. And they really got to adjust accordingly or face the consequences.
I want to just go back before I forget, when we were talking about Christina Caramo and whether or not she lasts and her inability to raise money. The word on the street is if she is replaced, that it's going to be with that fundraising juggernaut, Matt DiPerno, who couldn't necessarily, when he ran for office, couldn't raise enough to, you know, buy lunch for the state committee. So it's not like they're looking to make this move and bring in somebody in the vein of Bobby Shostak or Ron Weiser here. They're looking to replace, as I said when she was elected, the psychopath with the sociopath. They're not necessarily going to be upgrading their fundraising game. They're just going to be replacing one form of crazy faction of Republican with another leader of the crazy faction of the Republicans.
Well, one thing there too, Jeff, is, you know, at least whatever you want to say about Caramo, and there's a lot of bad things to say, at least she's not under criminal investigation like DiPerno. If he ends up in that spot, you know, he may not last long either. Of course, I guess you can run the Republican Party from jail or while you're on trial, you know, for violating the election laws of Michigan. But it's just like, see, you're going from bad to worse switching to Caramo. And again, I think it reinforces what Kyle was saying early about just what a bad look this is for the Republican Party. It just gets worse and worse.
I will say about DiPerno, now he told me after he lost the convention that he had $6 million in money that would be coming to the party if he were to be elected. He said he had commitments of that amount. And, you know, I just got to take him at his word if that's true. But I would also say about DiPerno, he does have more coalitions, I think, within the Republican Party to put together more of an apparatus. People who have been involved in politics in a while, Maddox's, the Donald Trump machine, such that it is, I think that he would have more connections to put things together. I don't know exactly how things are going for them, but I will say that I made my reservations for the Republican Leadership Conference, which I've gone to every year since I started at MERS in 2001. And so I made my reservations for the hotel that I wanted to stay at. And when I was talking to the person about my reservation, and I asked her what kind of rooms were available, her quick quip was, "Oh, we got lots of rooms available that weekend," which is not always the case.
Right.
That's not always the case, Jeff. So right. I just thought that was kind of telling. I'm thinking, well, shoot, I guess if nothing else, you know, I'll have a nice weekend up there. I mean, that the company's paying for up to this point.
If it happens, I mean, I've heard all kinds of, and you probably heard the same thing, that the conference is maybe a phantom or a mirage here, that it will actually come to fruition. I've also heard in the last couple of days that there is a faction of the kind of the old guard Republican. I heard the name Terry Lynn Land mentioned, that is looking at having an alternative leadership conference on the same weekend as Mackinac, but in Grand Rapids, is what I heard. Something that would be, you know, more well attended because it's more proximate to where people are, and that people don't want to be seen around Caramo's soiree if they end up having one. So it just, I think, I don't know the veracity of all of this. I mean, I've heard it from enough people that it sounds like at least there's something to it. And it just underscores the complete and total dysfunction within the Republican Party. And the one thing to point out, and I've pointed it out on this podcast and elsewhere quite often, is that really 80 to 85% of the Republican delegates are represented by or led by Matt DiPerno or Christina Caramo. That the number of people who aren't affiliated with either of those two camps, and what all, you know, I don't know, it's kind of like the Monty Python, the Judean People's Republic and the People's Republic of Judea fight. You know, it's hard to differentiate why these groups are actually different, but they don't seem to not like each other. But there we're really talking about, you know, 15 to 20% of the delegates, the grassroots, the old guard gentry leadership, that is the the quote unquote establishment Republicans. They're such a small number now that they really do kind of equate to the libertarians that you mentioned that get together and, you know, kind of debate, but don't really affect much anymore. But they can't get their arms or their minds around the fact that they don't control things the way they used to.
Maybe they should go down to Jackson under the Oaks there, Jeff. You know, kind of think about the good old days and form themselves a new party. It does seem like they're kind of wandering in the wilderness there.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I mean, the U.S. Senate race is going on and Alyssa Slotkin just seems to get stronger and stronger and stronger. And on the Republican side, there's just really nobody. This Michael Hoover guy is trying to make his name known, and he's going to be on our podcast coming up in our next edition. Nikki Snyder's out there, but she doesn't have a track record of being able to have success, you know, on that kind of a stage. You know, she couldn't get her signatures for the U.S. rep race. So, you know, we'll see. Maybe this will be different, but Mike Rogers isn't interested. Perry Johnson, they think they've got better shots running for president. So it's just really strange that we've got some John Tuttle guy who's a Wall Street executive. How does that fit with the current party? You know, Meyer would never win a primary. Just can't imagine he could win a primary having voted to impeach Trump. So it's really strange that, you know, the number one person they'd like is the guy who's already said he's not going to do it, which is John James. Just, it's really, for Republicans, it's got to be very deflating to watch that one of these very rare opportunities to win a U.S. Senate seat is just slowly going down the drain 18 months before you're even voting.
Yeah, it's astounding. We talked about this last week after Mackinac, how there in a normal functioning political party, there would have been candidates doing the rounds up there, trying to establish their chops and make those connections, rub elbows with the chattering class and the funders. And there was no sign whatsoever of any life on the Republican side. It's as if they've, you know, not only have they lost their ability to recruit top-notch candidates, they seem to have lost any kind of, I don't know, desire to even pretend that they're going to mount an effort. That they're just going to, you know, okay, we'll get the signatures for, you know, Nikki Snyder, and, you know, she can be our sacrificial lamb, you know, and if, you know, somehow, you know, lightning strikes and this turns into some kind of, you know, strange pro-Republican election year, she could catch lightning in a bottle. I just don't think that, you know, that's so far-fetched. It doesn't seem even something you can contemplate.
Well, a lot of this stuff, Jeff and Kyle, is also spreading to the courts. There's a huge fight going on. DiPerno's the lawyer for one of the factions between two Republican factions in Kalamazoo County. That's supposed to go to trial this summer. And so, you know, rather than have all the positive publicity of a Mackinac conference in the fall and all this other stuff, you know, we've got the specter of Republicans fighting it out in court for control of a county party. I mean, it's just remarkable to me to see just how far that party has fallen so quickly. So, Kyle, legislative agenda. What are they going to try to finish up this month? And then are they going to recess for the summer? They're going to keep working? Seems to me there's still a lot of things that the Democrats want to get done once they get through the budget and passing this voting legislation this summer. What's the legislative outlook?
Well, legislative outlook is my understanding is they still believe they can get this budget done before July 4th. That's going to mean that they're going to have to, the House and the Senate and the governor's office are going to have to agree to some spending targets for all the various departments. You know, we're taping this on Thursday, and the hope is that they can get it done over the weekend, and maybe on Monday we'll have something. But it's been, you know, it's difficult when you've never done this before and you're negotiating among friends. It can be a little difficult. And so setting these parameters with the administration has been hard. And then once you set those parameters, then you have the subcommittee chairs who have to settle literal dozens, if not 100 or a couple hundred items of difference within each budget. So that means the chairs are going line by line by line by line, talking about, okay, well, I'll give you this if I can have that. And if I can have this, I'll give you that. And this just goes on and on. I was talking to somebody yesterday who said that even a small budget, and I would mean like ag or DNR or something like that, has 120 some items of difference. And when you start getting into DHHS, I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of items of difference. So it's going to be hard. And then at the same time, yes, the implementation language of proposal two has been put on the front burner. And the clerks, Barb Byram, who I know you all had on this show here recently, really wants to have this early primary or this June primary legislation move. She says the clerks really, really need to know that on 2024's election, that they're not going to have overlapping deadlines between an August primary and a November general election. She said the mechanics of that just simply don't work, that there's an entire week where they're still ramping or they're still auditing the primary, but they're supposed to also be getting absentee ballots out to military for the general. She said it's not going to work. So she's really asking for that to be taken care of this month in June. It's a heavy ask. All these things kind of happening all at once. But, you know, that's kind of one of the downfalls of success is everybody wants a little bit more of you. And that's what they're dealing with right now. But as far as summer break, my understanding is they're still going to hold on that schedule. People have vacations scheduled and so on. And then they come back in the fall. And then also you've got this whole thought about Curtis Sertel, who is the governor's lobbyist. You know, the governor wants to get as much done as possible before he leaves, because the rumor is he's going to be running for Congress and he's going to get started in July. And without Curtis there to help make the trains run on time, it makes the negotiations on the budget even more difficult.
Well, squeezing from the other end, we haven't even talked about it, but it's out there, right? Democrats could lose one or two of their members in the fall if one or two of them get elected mayor. Now, they can lose one and still maintain a majority, but if they lose two, it's a tie. I understand under the rules, Speaker Tate remains Speaker, but you can't do anything if you got a tie body.
Yep. Well, yeah, then things get real tricky, because you're right, because under the rules, all the committees and everything stay the same, but on the floor, you're right, the Republicans can hold up everything if they want. So that's the other issue with adjourning early is they want to be able to have to, you know, have that flexibility to negotiate with Republicans if things come to that. But yeah, we won't know that until obviously November.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. And I know we're, you know, nearing the end of the time that we had told you we'd take from your busy schedule. You know, certainly, Kyle, we welcome you. Thank you for participating with our podcast. You know, give our listeners a chance. Tell them where to find your podcast that you've done now for a long, long time. Kind of the gold standard of podcasts in Michigan. No, you were one of the first and most consistent politically oriented podcast in Michigan. You've had great success. Mark and I have both been on your podcast over the years. And so tell our listeners where to find you also if they aren't aware.
Well, thanks for that, Jeff. Yeah, we've done the MERS Monday podcast since 2010. And it is on, I think all of the podcast apps now. You get it on Apple. That's where I get this podcast from. MERS Monday, MIRS Monday, and it does come out every Monday, as the name would entail. And sometimes I put it out early on, you know, like holiday weekends or something like that. But it's always up by Monday. And we've really had a good time with it. But yeah, you can check it out there if you want to get more information. And yeah, I just appreciate you all having me on. And I'm a frequent listener to the podcast. You guys added some great perspective and put things out there that I haven't thought of before. And, you know, so I get a lot of value out of it. So I'm glad that you all have kept it going.
Well, Kyle, it's a great podcast that you've got there, but I just want to quote Satchel Paige. Don't look back. They might be gaining on you. We are in hot pursuit.
I'm glad. Competition always makes people sharper. So keep it up.
That's our time for this week. Our great thanks to Kyle Malin for adding his insights to the conversation.
If the Republic is still standing and Canada doesn't bury us in ash, we will return next week.
A Republic If You Can Keep It with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.